Welcome to this afternoon's colloquium from the Department of Computer Science and Engineering. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce one of UW's stars, David Baker from the Biochemistry Department. David's been a faculty member in biochemistry only since 1993, so it's a relatively short time. He's also
pretty long for me.
He's also an adjunct faculty member in two other departments, the Genome Sciences Department and Bioengineering, and is a Howard Hughes Institute investigator. So this already gives you some indication that he's in demand and successful. I'm now going to read some of his awards, just to give you an idea of what David's of some of David's recognitions. I think if you're like me, these are going to cause you to want to resign your position and do something else. So David, since 1993, has received a Packard Fellowship, National Science Foundation's Young Investigator Award, a Beckman Foundation Young Investigator Award, a Protein Society Young Investigator Award, the Overton Prize from the International Society for Computational Biology, the Feynman Prize from the Foresight Institute, and the Newcomb Cleveland Prize from the Association for the Advancement of Sciences. So this is a very impressive list of awards. I'm going to add one more title to this that needs a little bit of explanation. David's going to be talking to us today about computing structural biology, and he'll explain better than I can what that means. But one of the things that he's done a lot of is trying to predict the three-dimensional structure of various proteins. And there is a competition that's held, I believe, every 2 years called CASP. And what happens at CASP is that the leaders from around the world get together and try to make predictions of the structures of proteins. And it's a competition to see who can get closest to the real structure. And David's team has been the team to beat at this for many, many years. So they've done much better than all of their competitors. So I take great pleasure in introducing to you the terror of CASP, David Baker.
All right, thanks, Martin, for that very nice introduction. Let's see, is there a pointer around? Uh-oh. Is there a big stick? This room is too high-tech. All right, well, I'll see how far I can get without one. No one has a pointer on. All right, so I'm not sure, I wasn't sure what the level of familiarity with biology there'd be in this audience, so please interrupt me if I say something you don't understand. The more interactive we can make this, the more likely it is that I'll pitch this at the right level of biology. So just to start, can I have a show of hands? How many people know what proteins are made out of? Oh, that's very impressive. Okay, all right. So you practically know everything. All right, so this will just be a brief... Well, how many people know what this is on the screen? Well, what is it? Okay, this is nothing. Okay, all right. Okay, this is a picture of a protein. It's actually the protein. It's a protein that's important to you right now. It's the potassium channel. So if you're thinking there are little... let's see how this works. Here. Okay. No. There's a little button, but nothing happens when I push it. Was it working when you used it? Okay, then I'm not pushing it. Okay, well, if I point this, so this is the potassium channel. That's a potassium ion going through the potassium ion going through this channel is what's important for the electric circuitry underneath the nervous system function. This is the flu virus coat protein. So if you've gotten the flu recently, this protein has. All right, great. Has gotten into you. And this one, hopefully you haven't experienced. This is the HIV coat protein bound to its receptor. So I'm just showing these for people who haven't looked at protein structures before. They are linear polymers. They have a beginning and an end, and they fold up into these very elaborate shapes, which are what allow them to do what to carry out their biological function, which may be good or, in this case, bad. So proteins are just some numbers here, which perhaps you all know. There are about 30,000 genes in the human genome. Each gene encodes about 1 to 5 proteins. It's to understand how proteins work, it's very important to know what their three-dimensional structures are. I showed you three-dimensional structures of a number of proteins. It's very expensive and difficult to determine protein structures, however. One has to use X-rays or get the protein to form crystals and then shine X-rays on it, or alternatively put it in a nuclear magnetic resonance machine. So, for example, that HIV coat protein I showed you took about 8 years to solve experimentally. So structural biology, the process of determining the structures of these proteins, is currently an experimental science. It's very tedious and very expensive. However, the structures of proteins and their functions are completely determined by their amino acid sequences. Okay, so there are 20 types of amino acids. Proteins consist of about 60 to 100 amino acids strung together. And the rule for going from amino acid sequences to protein three-dimensional structures is that the structure of the protein is at the global free energy minimum. So it's the lowest energy structure possible for the chain. What this means is that we should be able to compute structural biology. We should be able to compute structures by finding the conformation of lowest energy. So a little bit of geometry. It's not very important, but just I think actually if I can raise this up just temporarily, this is actually more than you need to know. But for those of you who haven't seen, so proteins are polymers. Here's one amino acid, two amino acids, three amino acids. The backbone of the polymer is repeats, and the amino acids are different from each other by virtue of these R groups that come off the protein backbone. There are 20 different types of R groups. There are 20 different types of amino acids. So as I've told you, a typical protein might have 100 amino acids. I didn't draw 100 here because I didn't want to, but you can see that would be a very large and complicated object. The degrees of freedom are, in what I'm going to tell you about, for almost everything, we keep these bonds fixed, that is, the distance and angles between these atoms, and the variables are going to be rotations around these angles. We call them torsion angles. So if you rotate around this angle, you will move this part of the structure out of the plane. For each structure along the backbone, there are 2 degrees of freedom, which can rotate around the full 360 degrees. In the side chains, I've just drawn one typical side chain here. They're between 1 and 4 degrees of freedom, so rotatable bonds. So all of the degrees of freedom in the problems I'm going to discuss are rotations around our torsion angles, like the one shown here. And this diagram up here just shows a blow-up, again, of these, the 2 degrees of freedom I've marked here are these two here. But we're not going to really care much about chemistry in this talk. So the amino acids, this just shows you that there are 20 of them, or I don't know if they're all listed. I think there are 20 listed here. They have different types. And just for the purposes of this talk, think of them as jigsaw puzzle pieces with different shapes. They're different from normal jigsaw puzzle pieces, however, in that each one can adopt some number of different conformations. So, for example, this one here can, one can usually, to a first approximation, discretize the rotations around these angles. And so, an amino acid, so one can think, approximately one has 3 possibilities for each rotatable bond. So you have between 1 and 100 possible shapes for each of these 20 amino acids. So we have jigsaw puzzle pieces, which can take on one of some number of possible shapes. Okay, that's all I'm going to say by way of introduction. So the theme of my talk is that structural biology should be computable and is becoming computable. So this largely experimental science is becoming a computational science. And that's why, if you're a graduate student in studying computational problems, this might be something to think about. As I've told you, protein structures determined by their amino acid sequences. Protein structures and the complexes formed by proteins correspond to global free energy minima. And so we should, instead of having determined protein structures experimentally, we should be able to simply, given the amino acid sequence of the protein, find the conformation with the lowest energy, and that will be the observed structure. That will be the correct answer. If we could do this, it would be a fundamental test of our understanding, and it would have huge practical relevance, because instead of having to spend $30,000 and 8 years to solve a protein structure, one could just type the sequence into a computer program and read out the structure an hour later, which would be cheaper, faster, and more elegant. So, as sort of an overview of the approach that we're taking, actually, maybe we should put this thing down now. Does it go any lower? Or is that? I think it looks like we're chopping off the bottom of the slide. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so I told you that proteins are at global free energy minima. So what we've got to do is have is a way of computing energies. And I'm going to say nothing about that in this talk. Just take it as a black box given a particular conformation of a protein, which means a particular value for all these degrees of freedom. We can compute the energy. So you can just think of it as a function of these torsion angles. I have to specify 200 numbers or 300 numbers, and I have a function which actually a subroutine, say, which will compute the energy. That's all you're going to have to know about it. Given such a black box method for computing the energy of a conformation, there are two types of problems we might want to do. The first one is a prediction problem. Given the sequence of a protein, that is, the identities of these R groups along the polymer, we may want to know what is the lowest energy structure. So that would be the traditional structure prediction problem. On the other hand, we may have a three-dimensional structure to begin with and want to know what's the lowest energy sequence for that structure. In this case, we're given the values of all these torsion angles here, which correspond to a unique three-dimensional structure, and we want to know what combination of R groups will fit into that structure, will give that structure the lowest energy. These same ideas apply immediately to the problem not only of protein structures, but the way that many proteins work is they interact with other proteins. And so to find out how two proteins interact, we have to find the arrangement of those two proteins, which has the lowest energy, or that would be the protein-protein docking problem, which I'm going to talk about in just a moment. Or we may want to create a new interface between two proteins. So all of this is done with a computer program that we've been developing over the last 8 years or so called Rosetta. It contains a model for the energetics of these interactions and then various algorithms for doing either this prediction problem or the design problem. What I'm going to do today is tell you where we are in terms of being able to compute protein structures and interactions and create new ones. So the challenge, I'll tell you right off, is basically global optimization. So we've got a function. We'll talk about the prediction problem. We've got a function of a very large number of degrees of freedom, and we have to find the global minimum. I'm going to start by telling you about the protein-protein docking problem. That's the problem of finding the lowest energy relative orientation of two proteins, because it's a simpler problem. There are fewer degrees of freedom. And the way that what you're basically going to get a feeling with for in this talk is how we approach this very challenging global optimization problem in a high-dimensional space. And let's see. So basically, the way we start is to average out, to basically integrate out as many of the degrees of freedom as we can to make the problem simpler. So what we do essentially is to represent these R groups, not in their full atomic detail, but just as single points. We carry out a Monte Carlo search, which means we, starting from some random orientation, we make random perturbations and accept those perturbations for which the energy decreases or at least doesn't increase beyond a certain amount. This will give us approximate docked arrangements of the two proteins. Then the next step is to add back all of the atomic detail, all the full atomic representation of these R groups, and evaluate the energy. At that point, it's very much like trying to do a jigsaw puzzle. You've got these different shapes for the different amino acids, and you're trying to move the puzzle around so as to get the amino acids to fit together as well as possible. There are very, very large numbers of local minima on this landscape, and the most effective strategy we found is to do very, very large numbers. So here I have about 100,000 of independent runs, so independent calculations starting from a different random number seed. The analogy I like is, suppose you're trying to find the lowest elevation point on a large planet. So you've landed on Jupiter, and our approach would correspond to having 100,000 explorers parachute down on the surface of Jupiter in different locations and do searches in those vicinities and then basically communicate back to a central base the lowest energy point, lowest elevation point that they found. So this is just recapping some of what I've said. I think I'll skip through that. We have the proteins diffusing relative to each other. And there's a lot on this slide. I think just focus on this part here. This is now when we get to the full atomic detail. The problem I told you is that we've got these degrees of freedom within the R groups themselves. So even if we know what the sequence is, if we know what the identity of the R group is, we don't necessarily know its shape. So basically the approach here is we start with we've got some relative orientation of the two proteins. We make a random perturbation to the rigid body orientation of the two proteins in this case. So there's 6 degrees of freedom. We need to specify the rigid body orientation. We make random perturbation to some subset of those. That'll give us a new orientation. At that point, we basically do discrete optimization of the different shapes for each amino acid. So we basically try out the different combinations of shapes. Here's different amino acids, and here's possible shapes that they can take on. That's what's called repacking here. So when we change the shapes of these amino acids, it leads us down to a new landscape, and then at the end we carry out quasi-Newton minimization to go to the nearest local minimum. This is very important, doing this minimization step at the end, because these landscapes are very, very bumpy. So it's as if you're trying to do a jigsaw puzzle, you make some random move of some pieces relative to each other, and then you do minimization to find the nearest local minimum, the best fit of the jigsaw puzzle pieces in that vicinity. Okay, now this is this is fairly representative of some important features of the problem. So what I have here is the energy. This is how close the structure is to, in this case, an arbitrary starting structure. This is a problem where we did not know what the correct structure was at the time. This was from a competition such as the one that Martin described, where we were given two proteins and had to find, or were asked to predict what the docked arrangement was. Each red point corresponds to the lowest energy structure found in an independent low resolution followed by high resolution search. So there are a couple of things you can see here. First of all, the range in energies is quite big. These are scattered all over the map. And so are the structures, in the sense that they're quite different from each other. If they were all the same, they'd be clustered at some value of the RMSD, that's the root mean square deviation on the atom coordinates. So it's clear from this that there are very, very large numbers of local minima, because each one of these calculations ends up in a local minimum. Another thing you can see is that there are a small number of trajectories, which ended up in a minimum which is considerably deeper than any of the other minima. You can see that there's a substantial energy gap between these points and this vast majority of the points here. So what we did, or what we do in situations like this, is now start additional calculations from these points here. And when one does that, map out this fairly narrow minimum, almost like a funnel, that's surrounding these low energy points. We didn't see these points before because we were doing, this is a very, very large space, and we didn't sample finely enough. So now we're sampling much more finely to the true structure. So what you can see is that these points, in fact, lie at the bottom of a bounced narrow minimum. Now, what those actually correspond to is a specific arrangement of two proteins, and I'm showing the correct answer over here on the right. The structure that was determined experimentally by growing crystals of the protein and then shining X-rays at it is shown in red and orange. The computed structure, which was computed well before we knew what the right answer is shown in blue. So you can see that the actual structure and the predicted structure are superimposed based on the coordinates of this partner. So you can see that the rigid body orientation of these two proteins is very close to correct. And now if I blow up the interface, you can see what was giving rise to the energy gap. These are these amino acid R groups coming down from one partner, and here we have the amino acid R groups coming up from the other partner. This green one is an amino acid whose internal coordinates changed during the docking process. So we started off with the structure of the red protein and the structure of the yellow protein, but we knew where the backbone was, but we didn't know where the side chains were, and this is one which moved during the docking process. So why was there that very pronounced minimum? Well, you can see what's going on here. It really is like a jigsaw puzzle. These different side chains are fitting together very, very precisely, and you can imagine that as you move these two proteins relative to each other, the complementarity of the two shapes decreases considerably, and that leads to an increase in energy, because the energy is largely measuring the extent of fit. So I think at that point, yeah, go ahead.
So I've got a question. You're saying that the light green one shifted during the docking process. So I'm guessing the confirmation of that light green one was at a higher energy level then?
Well, yeah. So if you had...
Which is why you didn't predict it as a possibility in that area?
Well, if you look here, if you had this original light green shape here, it would bump into this red one here. Mm-hmm. And that would be evaluated as being very high in energy. So if you kept this one fixed here, you wouldn't have been able to find this solution. Are there other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that it's a pretty close configuration. We can see that in the graph. How much does it matter if it's off by just a little bit like this? Is it useful still?
Yeah, this is within the resolution of the experiment that determined the structure, and it's certainly useful enough for any biological purpose. Usually what one wants to know is the main thing one wants to know is which amino acids are at the interface, and that certainly you can see here, you get them all right. You also want to know what their conformations are, and that's correct as well. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do you ever have two minimum that are quite different, that are about equal in energy but are quite far apart in structure?
Yes. So, so there's two questions. First of all, how often is that likely to occur in nature? There are some protein complexes and some proteins which clearly exist in two different states. And though there may be some biology there, so one state may do one thing under certain circumstances, under different circumstances, it may be different environmental conditions, it may be in a different structure. Those are more the exception than the rule. So for most systems, one can assume, so essentially all systems, one can assume that there is a single global minimum. However, our ability to compute energies is not perfect. And more importantly, as I'll get to in a moment, we can't, because of the sizes of the space, we can't always get close enough to the correct minimum to get in very deep in the well. It's like you might be comparing the Dead Sea to Death Valley, say, and trying to figure out which is lower. And as long, if you aren't getting to the bottom, to the very bottom of both, you can't really be sure. And so we often have the situation that there are multiple minima, and we can't tell which one's the correct one because we haven't been able to get to the very lowest point. Yeah.
So, I mean, these are computational physics. I mean, in the physical structures that are doing the docking, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you said that, well, they're going to achieve a global minimum or something like that. But in principle, they are computing devices. Not all things in the physical world actually achieve their global minima. So maybe you're doing better in general for a similar reason than you're only able to compute a certain object.
Right. And, you know, it's very hard. It's very easy to prove that an object is not at a global minimum because you find something that's lower in energy. It's very hard to prove that you have found the global minimum, right? I mean, that holds for both, you know, for both computations and for actually experimentally. So it's more of a hypothesis than anything else, but it's certainly consistent with everything that we know, that if you prepare the system in different ways, you always get the same solution, essentially. Yeah.
So you mentioned that there are times when you find two equivalent to your resolution global minimum.
Yeah.
Does that give you any advantage? So once you get there, you can't refine your resolution. Does that give you an advantage in maybe going back to the experimental approach and trying to refine the answer and get a single answer out of that? Or does it, it doesn't give you any progress?
Right. So in that case, you'd need some additional information to resolve the ambiguity, right? So if you had some experimental information, it might be consistent with one of your minima and not the other. So that would be, in fact, we've done that in a number of cases. Actually, recently, that was used in the case of the anthrax toxin. There was a group at Harvard who was trying to model the anthrax toxin, and we built models using this procedure, parts of it, and they had some experimental data. They had made changes in the amino acids at the interface and knew which ones disrupted the interaction, and having that kind of data gave us much more confidence that our model was correct. So, for example, these are amino acids which were known to be at the interface, and you can see they actually are. I think this is just another example of a prediction that was made, again, blind. We didn't know what the answer was in advance. Again, the same sort of docking procedure. And, again, I'm going to show you a blow-up of this interface here. And, again, I guess the thing that you should note is, again, the almost jigsaw puzzle-like packing here. And that is one of the things that makes us, that gives rise to these significant energy gaps when we can find them. But it's also one of the things that makes the problem difficult. Because if you imagine algorithms for doing jigsaw puzzles where the pieces can take on a number of different shapes are very difficult. I mean, it's a difficult problem. And So this is now a simpler problem, finding the global minimum for two proteins diffusing relative to each other. As I said, there's only really six rigid body degrees of freedom in addition to degrees of freedom of all these side chains here. However, there of course is a more complicated version of this problem where in addition to the side chains, the protein backbone itself can vary. There you suddenly have many more degrees of freedom, and that's a problem that we're currently working on now. So the first problem we've been able to solve, at least, you know, I think, too, is this problem, or being able to, first thing we can compute reasonably reliably is how two proteins come together if we know what the conformation of the protein backbone is. Okay, so now that's all I'm going to say about this problem. So now let's talk about the classical, what's called the ab initio structure prediction problem, where we're simply given an extended chain like this and the identities of these R groups. And so what you see up here is a calculation where we're searching for low energy structures, or low energy structure given this sequence. We start off again with a low resolution model where the side chains are just represented by single points. And what you see here is a movie of such a calculation, which in this case ends up in a conformation which is pretty close to the correct one, but that is rare. That is actually not usually the case. So again, we carry out very large numbers of calculations like this. Each one takes a couple minutes on a computer, and we have then to pick out the correct structures. This is almost identical to the slide I showed you before. This just shows the second stage in the procedure, where we're now going back and adding on the full atomic detail using this sidechain optimization followed by quasi-Newton minimization. And this is now a movie showing that second part. You can see there's much less movement, and you can again see sort of the jigsaw puzzle-like character. You see things just kind of jiggling around in the interior there. All right, so what we have, this sort of shows a more or less representative case. If we these are six different proteins. Again, this is the energy here versus the RMSD, how far away the structures are from correct. And zero means that the structures are basically perfect. If we start at the correct structure, because we know it from experiments, we find that the structures that we generate almost always have lower energies than structures that we generate using the two movies that I just described, starting from an extended chain. You can see that the problem is that we're not generally getting close enough. These structures are not coming close enough to the minimum to be captured, essentially. And the structures have to come close enough for the energy to drop enough so that you can tell you're there. So it's as if you're trying to find this valley on the surface of this planet, and the valley has a pretty narrow aperture. And you really have to get close before you can tell that it's a valley, that the elevation is decreasing radically. So much of the work going on in my group now is trying to develop algorithms for searching this space more effectively, that is, sampling, ensuring that you have sampling close enough to the native structure to identify it based on its energy. Now, we've been making a lot of progress, and a lot of this is the work of Phil Bradley, who hopefully you'll be hearing more from soon as he's applied this department. He's really a fabulous guy. And this just shows a prediction from the CASP competition that Martin just mentioned, and this is now a superposition of the correct structure with the experimentally determined structure, now just for the backbone, and it's really quite close. So in this case, Phil was able to get a model, a prediction that was close enough to the correct structure that its energy was significantly lower than all other structures. And if you look what's holding that protein together, these are the shapes of the side chains in the core, and they are, again, fitting together in almost a jigsaw puzzle-like way, which is what's giving these things lower energy. So I'll show you a couple more examples. Now, these examples are not from blind tests. These are from cases where we knew the answer, and so you have to take them with a little bit of a grain of salt. But again, the same type of plot. This is energy versus RMSD. If we start at the native structure, we get these blue points. Now what we're trying to do is use lots of computer power, sampling a lot, and some tricks involving homologous protein sequences that are likely to fold to the same structure but have different sequences. If we put them through this process, they'll sample different parts of this space, and so we get much better coverage than if we just use a single sequence. So I'm going to show you now these structures that Phil found that were the lowest energy structures found in the calculation. And this is an example. This is now a superposition of the true structure with the lowest energy structure found in the calculation. And even if you're not used to looking at proteins, I think you can see that, again, the jigsaw puzzle-like fit of the side chains is really quite good. So we're really capturing a lot about what holds this protein together. You can see, however, though, going back to the previous slide, that there's still a substantial gap between the energy of these structures and the energy of the native structures. And it's a little bit unintuitive. I was quite surprised. We found that it's actually very difficult to go from here to here, even though the structures are very similar. It's just that there's so many the when you make a move, the chance of collisions between atoms is very, very high. It's almost like you need some sort of way to concertedly move everything together to sort of get the last stage of clicking in. It's kind of like those toys that you might have had when you're sort of little puzzles, these three-dimensional puzzles where you got to move the right pieces in the right order at the right time to get everything to click together. And again, if you think about algorithms for solving that type of problem, it's pretty tough. Is there a question there?
Previous plot, what was the red dot?
The red, there's a red arrow just showing the low, just indicating where the lowest energy structure is. Any other questions? Yeah.
So that blue in the lower left-hand corner, you're saying you start at the perfect structure.
Yeah.
And you apply your algorithm.
Yeah.
And it starts to move away from the minimum.
Yeah. Yeah.
That seems a little strange.
Well,
if that perfect structure is the minimum.
Right. But remember, the perfect structure is determined experimentally. And there are two issues. One is the protein's in a crystal, so its minimum may be different. The minimum when it's in a crystal may be different from when it's by itself, as it is in our calculation. More importantly, our description of the world is not perfect. So the location of the minimum, the true minimum, is not going to be exactly at the location of our computed minimum. We don't have access to nature's energy function. We have something that we've constructed, but it's not perfect. Other questions? Okay, so I have a bunch of other pictures, which I'll just show you one more. This is, again, lots of independent calculations. Each one is the end point of a different run. Here's the lowest energy point. And again, a superposition shows that these are really quite close. Okay, yes, I wanted to show you this one. So this doesn't happen all of the time. This only happens. We did calculations on 16 proteins. It only happened 6 out of 16 times that the lowest energy structure was really close to the correct answer. This is the worst case, where the lowest energy structure is out here, but the correct minimum is here. So that was sort of like a question that was asked earlier. So what's the problem? The problem isn't really with our description of the world, in that if we'd gotten here, we would have been able to identify it. However, the problem is more that we just never came close. So we were limited by how well we could sample. We never sampled anywhere in the vicinity of the correct structure. And that's why the sampling problem is really the formidable challenge to overcome. Any questions about that?
So,
yeah.
So when you use the Metropolis algorithm, do you use a single flip update or you use a clustering algorithm?
Let's see. Well, in terms of the number of degrees of freedom being varied simultaneously, it ranges between 1 and about 15. So we're changing groups of adjacent degrees of freedom, or just, you know, we have many different types of moves, but we're still not, you know, they still aren't sufficient. So one possibility, yeah.
What do you mean by inadequate sampling? I thought you were just speaking in the U.S.
Well, what we're doing is we have the amino acid sequence. What's inadequate is we're not sampling. This is sort of a measure of how far structures are from the correct structure. We never generate anything which was really close to the correct structure. So we're not sampling possible conformations enough, because if we sampled enough, if we had enough... So you're trying to cover this huge space. It's like you landed on Jupiter, you threw down all these explorers, but there was this really deep valley you just totally missed. You didn't have anyone go close to. So how are we approaching this problem? And that's sort of what I want to close with. As I've described so far, our basic workhorse approach is we start off with this low-resolution representation, coarse grain search. We then go to this high-resolution description. The search at both levels is Monte Carlo with minimization. So we're doing a random change to some set of torsion angles, updating the side chains, and then minimizing. And we're doing very large numbers of short calculations starting from different random number seeds. So how can we improve this? Well, one obvious idea is we could do an initial set of calculations, and that would give us, if you imagine, the space defined by all these degrees of freedom, the torsion angles, to each each structure that we generate corresponds to a particular combination of torsion angles, and we know its energy. So say there are 200 angles that we're varying, then we have a space of 200 dimensions, and for each point we know what its energy is, not for each of our samples. So what we'd really like to do then is build a map of this landscape, the surface, in the energy surface in this 200-dimensional space. Once we had such a map, we can identify the regions which are promising, which are relatively low in energy, where we might want to go back and explore more. You can see that this type of method will work well in some cases, but not in others. It would work poorly in this case because when we built a map, we would conclude that this is a very promising region to look in, but of course it's a total red herring. One thing you might think about doing is trying to reduce the dimensionality of the problem. A space with 200 or 1,000 dimensions is very difficult to work in. So one thing that we're experimenting with is taking the set of structures that we generate and calculate the principal components of variation among those structures. And if we just take the first 10 or 50 principal components and treat those as the degrees of freedom, we have very many fewer parameters to worry about. We can build up a map of this surface, do the same thing I just alluded to, but instead of building the map in a space with 500 dimensions, we can build it in a space with 10 dimensions. And again, use this to guide subsequent sampling. Another possibility is to define some set of discrete features with different possible states that that we can then assign any structure to. So, for example, you might take one of these degrees of freedom here, like this one here, and say, to a first approximation, I'm going to allow it to have three states. I can do that with each degree of freedom I've got, and so I can project my continuous space down into a discrete one, and we call these barcodes. So every structure that we generate can be given a code which describes its describes the structure, the discretized version of the structure. So how can we use these barcodes? One way is in a taboo-type search. One thing you obviously want to do when you're searching, doing any kind of search of a big space, is you don't want to repeat yourself. So we can use these codes to keep track of where we've been and to reduce sampling in those regions. Another thing we can do is to use codes to try to spread out the different calculations as much as possible. So each run starts with a different random number seed, but you can imagine that two calculations starting with the same random number seed may funnel in to the same minimum. And if we want to keep things spread out, we might want to prevent that. And so what we can do is give each calculation a different randomly chosen state vector, which describes what part of this barcode space is going to, this discretized space is going to do the search in. This will ensure that each run will stay spread out as much as possible. The final way, another way, is we can identify features which are present in the lowest energy structure and then try and resample those regions. They may not correspond to global structural properties, but any particular any particular property of these conformations that we can define, we can identify the state that feature has in the lowest energy structures and make more with that. So this is just an example, something that Phil's been working on that's quite neat. So he's been looking at the problem of forming proteins have beta strands, which are basically linear elements which pair with one another. And in general, you can recognize what those elements are from the sequence to some extent. So if you have 8 beta strands, there are a limited number of ways in which they can pair with each other. And the pairings constitute one possible set of feature vectors describing the pairings. So what Phil developed that's shown up here is a method for building up structures which is analogous to that movie I showed you earlier where the protein was flailing all over the place, but where you specify some set of pairings at the beginning and maintain them through the structure. This requires replacing the linear representation of the protein with a branched tree representation, which I'm not going to go into more here, but hopefully you'll be hearing about from Phil. With this method, here's actually a graphical representation. So you start with the continuous chain. You want to preserve pairings between these two residues and these two residues. So if you cut the chain here and here, you now have a graph which, and given this graph, you can build up any structure you want as you start changing the degrees of freedom. So the way this can be used is to identify pairings that are present. I should define what this plot is. This is a plot of contacts. This is the amino acid residues 1 through 100, say, along this axis, and 1 through 100 along this axis. And what these dots indicate is that the amino acids are close together in three-dimensional space. So these linear elements are shown in yellow along the diagonal here. Along the diagonal are interactions that are close to get between amino acids which are close to each other in space. So this red block, for example, would correspond to an interaction between this element here and this element here. And I'm not going to go into this in detail, but basically by rewarding, it turns out that during these calculations, as you might imagine, these elements which are close together tend to pair, simply because they're close to each other, it's much easier for that to happen. And that gives rise to these very highly populated rectangular regions along the diagonal. The color indicates how frequently this contact is observed in a set of about 1,000 generated structures. So with the original version of the program, you generate all these pairings right along the diagonal. So then in a second round, so Phil identifies these features and then basically does a second round where he stochastically disfavors these features along the diagonal. That generates this set of features here. These are ones which are anti-parallel, and these are ones which are parallel. But the important point is that now we're getting better sampling of these non-local, more sequence-distant features. And the black ones, it's a little bit hard to see. The ones that have the black boxes are actually the correct ones. But, of course, you don't know that in advance. So now, this resampling idea is you identify the features that are present frequently in the low-energy structures, which would be some of these green ones, and you make additional structures which have those features by construction using the method I just described. And this is now a third generation of structures which is made randomly picking these features and making structures with them. And you can see these two features which are correct are standing out. And then this is a final fourth round, again, taking features which are prevalent at this level and making more structures that have them there. And so what happens is at each stage, you're enriching for the lowest energy features, and it turns out in most cases, you're also enriching for the correct features. And let's see. What do I have here? Sorry. I have some pictures of the predictions that Phil's made using this method, and they're really quite remarkable. They're for much more complicated proteins than we could use before. I'll show you one example before here. This is the correct structure with a lot of these linear elements paired in quite a complex way, and this is the structure that Phil predicted. This is, again, in this blind CASP prediction experiment. Very, very close. All right. So we need a lot of computing, and for a while last year, I was kind of wringing my hands. You can imagine we found that the correct solution to both this docking problem and the structure prediction problem is almost always the lowest energy. So if we had enough computing power and could find the lowest energy structure, we could solve structural biology, essentially. But where was all the computing power going to come from? Well, we've taken a big step towards solving that problem with a distributed computing project. This is using the Boink software developed by the SETI at home people, who are a little bit tired of looking for intelligent life that might not exist and are very happy to help people who have more real world problems. And so they've made their software available to us. And this is, I just pulled this off the web this morning. This is the number of computers enlisted in our project. It started in September. By the beginning of November, we had 21,000, and here we are in January with about 81,000 processors, and it's not really showing much sign of... It's every day we're adding about 500 new computers. So basically, this means that obviously you don't buy computers anymore because every day we get more than we could possibly ever buy. However, it also means that you have about 30,000 people who are more or less like needy children who have constant complaints about why their computer isn't working and why they aren't getting credit for this. And so the whole sociology is very interesting. So I spend part of my time now trying to address upset people about why things didn't work on their computer. But it also gives me an opportunity to try and explain a lot of what we're trying to do to a lot of people, which is kind of fun also. Okay, so I'm almost at the end here. So I showed you that we can compute aspects of structural biology that more computing but we need better algorithms, which is why it's worth it for me to talk to people like you. If you're interested in algorithms for doing these type of problems, please talk to me. And I just wanted to close with the point that I wasn't really going to go into, but we can invert this problem to say we want to make a particular protein structure. Here's a structure we want. Find me a sequence. Find the lowest energy sequence for that structure. So can we make brand new molecules? And we've done that. We've come up with an amino acid sequence which folds up to this structure. It's as if you drew something on the back of an envelope and wanted to come up with an amino acid sequence which was folded to that structure. This now shows a superposition of the experimentally determined structure of this protein that we made with the model we were trying to make, and they're very, very close. So we can make new molecules, and this is exciting. There are all kinds of things that we might be able to do. One thing that we're particularly excited about is trying to design a vaccine for HIV, because I guess in the question period I can describe how we're trying to do that. But that we can make a whole host of molecules that biology never came across. In particular, there was never any evolutionary pressure to create vaccines. And so we think now with this design approach, we can now create molecules which will be effective vaccines. We're also trying to create new molecules that will catalyze new chemical reactions, for example, for bioremediation. And we're designing proteins that interact with other molecules, for example, with DNA. So we've been able to, for those of you who know some biology, know that there are proteins whose job is to cut DNA in very specific locations, at very specific sequences. And if you could design proteins which cut DNA at targeted sites, you could, for example, cure some diseases that are caused by genetic, by changes in the genome, because you could cut those genes that were causing problems. And I think that's so that we've actually been able to do that. This is for the biochemists in the audience, and there aren't any, so I don't need to show it, but we do a little bit of experimental work, and we've been able to design an enzyme which cuts DNA at a completely unique site, and we're now trying to use this for therapeutic purposes. Okay, I'm going to stop here. All of the work on protein structure prediction I talked about was done by Phil Bradley, who was going to go to MIT but is now reconsidering. Let's see, who else did I talk about work? It was on the protein-protein docking. Jeff Gray is now at Johns Hopkins, Nora Furman, who's now at Hebrew University, graduate student Chu Wang, who's still in my group. Brian and Gautam designed this new protein. Justin and Jim created this new new nuclease. and, of course, this is very important. You all have to go and list your computers in this distributed computing project, point.bakerlab.org/Rosetta, and all our software is freely available for academic use, and there are people here who are going to make sure that stays true and gets to everyone who needs it. So I'll stop there. Sure. Any more questions? Yeah.
Suppose you had a protein sequence that was just laid out in a very long line in the real world. If you just let it sit, would it fold itself into its optimal configuration?
Yes, it would. Yes. And there are We do some experiments on that process in my lab, at least we used to. So you can take a protein, pull it apart so it's a straight line, and let it go, and it will relax back to the lowest energy structure.
But presumably there is something difficult about following that dynamically. That's the reason you haven't used that approach to reduce.
Well, you can't see what it does. So you don't know. I mean, the protein has a lot of time, right? Because this process happens in seconds. So a second seems like a short time, but in terms of the elementary steps, you can imagine an elementary step happening in a fraction of a nanosecond. So it's a lot of elementary steps. So we don't know exactly what the protein's doing during that time, and even if we did, it's not clear it would help because it might correspond to more computation than we have accessible.
It would seem like it would be, in principle, predictable by principles of quantum mechanics.
Yes, right. In principle, one can compute. Well, right. I mean, using quantum mechanics, you could compute the energy of every possible state, but that's not going to solve the sampling problem, right? It would take. You still have to, even given a perfect, the ability to compute exactly what the energy is for every possible state of the protein. You can't do this by exhaustive enumeration because there are far too many states. So you need some method for identifying promising regions and focusing attention on them.
Yeah. Some proteins need other proteins to help them fold.
Yes.
And I was wondering if the protein that you designed, I mean, I would just imagine it was short enough that it didn't need any help.
Right. So most proteins that require other proteins to fold, what the other protein is doing is preventing the protein from basically misfolding, instead of forming a monomeric structure, interacting with itself or with other proteins in an inappropriate way. Our protein in particular will fold on its own. It's a question that was asked previously. Most proteins, when you pull them apart and allow them to relax, will fold to the correct structure. However, if they're present with lots of other proteins, sometimes they will interact with those other proteins instead. So. Yeah.
Does Rosetta compute, prionic misfolds, or have you not gotten to?
Yeah. So in prions, what's happening is the protein, rather than forming a monomeric structure, it's forming long fibrils by interacting. Each copy interacts with another copy of itself, and so that problem is difficult because now you have the protein varying, and you have to, and also the rigid body orientation of the molecules coming together. Varying. So we are doing work on on amyloid-like proteins, but that's based on a recently determined crystal structure of a fibril. And using these design methods, we've actually been able to identify or predict to some extent what sequences will form these fibrils and which ones won't.
Is there a correlation between the size of the protein and the difficulty?
Yes, there is a very, very strong correlation. It's because the number of degrees of freedom, the number of variables, grows up linearly with the length of the protein, and the number of states grows up exponentially. So at some level, the protein becomes, this problem becomes exponentially hard because, the successes I showed you for the structure prediction stuff in the second part of my talk was all for very relatively small proteins. For larger proteins, the spaces are so big that we essentially never get close enough. So really trying to focus now on the smallest problems. Yeah.
So in the examples you had, figure out what the structure would be given a sequence and given a structure, what would be a good sequence.
Yeah.
Now, the HIV example you suggest, it's not clear exactly what shape of structure you might want for the sequence. So this seems like a one step beyond those two.
Well, I didn't tell you enough. That's the problem. So the problem with HIV is that there are this co-protein, which is on the outside of the virus. Much of it is changing very, very rapidly. That's why it's hard to get an immune response to it. There are small regions which can't change. Those are like the Achilles heels of the virus. Okay, so if you made antibodies, if you had an immune response to those regions, you could destroy the virus. In fact, there are a very small number of antibodies called neutralizing antibodies which attack those regions and they eliminate the infection. The problem is when you get an HIV infection, your immune system is attracted to all this on the surface, and so all of the immune response goes to that part of the protein, and these Achilles heels regions are invisible. So what our idea is we're going to build, or we are building, small proteins which present those Achilles heels regions. We know what their sequence is, and we also know what their structure is because we have crystal structures of the antibody bound to those regions. So now we want to build proteins which will present those regions in a way that they're very visible to the immune system, sort of the inverse of the way they are in the virus. And that's the basic idea. Yeah.
I was wondering what you would do about gated channels that have two configurations.
Yeah, right.
It depends on external conditions like a multi shift
or
something else.
Yeah.
You can start with it stretched out, but maybe you could.
Yeah,
that's right. So modeling changes like that is sort of the next level of complexity. That would be the case where there are two distinct minima. There is, in fact, someone here at the University of Washington who's using these techniques to actually try and model the changes that occur during changes in the potassium channel. So you can use these methods. It's a harder problem because now you have to worry about multiple low energy states. Yeah.
Have you ever tried just exponential growth, but two strands or two stranded proteins, sort of like hemoglobin or with four strands?
Yeah, right. Well, we could do that problem if, in the case of hemoglobin, you would predict probably a structure of the individual monomers and then bring the monomers together. That will work for cases where the monomers are stable as independent units. If the monomers are not stable as independent units, don't have unique structures, and only have unique, well-defined conformations when the thing comes together, it's too hard for us now. I can tell you how difficult the problem is simply by counting the number of degrees of freedom. And that type of problem, you know, if you had 100 residue protein that formed a tetramer, like that case, or 200, and the structure of the print, divide, and conquer, it would just be too big and too hard.
Thank you again.